Lawrence Jackson is the latest guest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Lawrence is the head of film practice in the School of Arts at the University of Kent. He has taught screenwriting, and we find out at the beginning of the interview why Lawrence especially relates to the protagonist in the comedy film Mindhorn. We talk about growing up in Guildford. We talk about Wookiee Hole. We talk about Lawrence's earliest memories. We talk about Blake Seven and Doctor Who. Being surrounded by lots of whodunit novels, loving pop music, ELO, why the Travelling Wilburys were gold dust, and why his housemates didn't necessarily think quite the same way. We talk about going through a phase of liking San Francisco acid rock. We share memories of the Goombe Dance Band and Seven Tears. We may not actually quite be in agreement on this one. We talk about how Lawrence entered academia, why it's important not to censor people's ideas. He studied modern languages at Oxford, went to Bournemouth Film School, and he worked for BBC Northern Ireland. He talks about his experience of sitting on the Berlin Wall in 1989. He talks about his family's background, why he was disappointed with the result of the 1992 general election. We find out why Lawrence's memories are predominantly positive, why it was that going to boarding school at the age of 13 was a key experience. We find out whether Lawrence has fulfilled the dreams he had when he was young, and why he is more of a looking forward than a looking back type of person. So join me for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. My guest this week is Lawrence Jackson. So it is my pleasure this morning to interview Lawrence Jackson from the School of Arts. And we've known each other, I would say, what, 4 or 5 years?
Yes.
Yeah. And you, as I recall, are a film practitioner, and you came here for a very different sort of route. Is that right?
I did, yes. So yeah. I came in the side door, if not the back door, from the film and television and radio industry. And I was a radio producer, writer-director, worked in script development and directing actors. Those are my areas of expertise. And then I started teaching screenwriting here and moved into teaching other film practice modules. And now I'm head of film practice at the School of Arts. So that's midwifing short films, short fiction films made by our students.
Yeah. So your students, as part of their assessment, will be making films?
Absolutely. So this term, the Stage 3 module that I convene is called Microbudget Filmmaking Fiction. And they have to turn around the inception and the development and the execution of a 10 to 15 minute short film in 12 weeks, which they should be able to do by the age of 21, 22. And so it's the whole thing. It's development, production, post-production by the first week of April.
You see, I always feel that when I'm teaching my students, it's always looking at other people's projects, other people's work. It's almost as though other people have done the work, and then I'm going through it and unravelling it and critiquing it and assimilating and all the rest of it. Although I suppose now with these interviews, I'm starting to develop primary sources. But that's just brilliant, to actually be able to have control over the output and actually say, this is our work, yeah, rather than wait for somebody to come along and produce something or make something that you can glean something from for the purposes of academic study, actually making that as that product as part of academic study.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I thought I would be bitter or disillusioned a few years ago, because I'm a writer-director myself, and I'm exec producing, in effect, other people's work. And I'm not bitter or disillusioned yet. I'm sure I will be, but it's basically inspiring. You just don't know what you're going to get. Last year, probably 4 out of 10 short films were quite weak. And this year, I'm going to jinx it, they're looking really strong. It seems like an outstanding cohort. So you don't know what you're going to get. It could be something about 1 year, there's an idea about goblins that's going to use latex special effects. I mean, who knew? Goblins in Kent, it's kind of a metaphorical fantasy vision. So I love that aspect. And often where the students fall down is poor organisation, poor attendance, lack of discipline. So the film is, as it were, undercooked, right? So it's common sense. And it is a very important stepping stone for them, for their development, but also in their careers, what they're going to go on to do. So micro-budget relates, I relate it in the screenings to people's first feature films that are often terrible.
Well, because I often see at the Gulbenkian a few short films that have been made by students. Yeah. So is that what you're involved with?
We have shown some of our students' films once or twice, and usually if it's not at the Gulbenkian, I'll show them, there'll be a showcase at the Lupino, also on campus. And they enter the films into festivals, and whether it's in Kent or Los Angeles or elsewhere. So it's a lot of fun, usually, but sometimes production headaches and lots of other issues.
Yeah. And no doubt we'll be talking about film in just a minute when we go through some questions. But just to say, I remember particularly you giving a talk on Mindhorn at the Gulbenkian, which is one of those films now. I've realised I've seen it in three different cinemas.
Have you?
I saw it in Broadstairs at the Palace, I saw it at Faversham, and I saw it with your introduction at the Gulb. And it's also the film, I've got a few films, Groundhog Day is another one, which I've got on multiple formats. It's almost as though I'm carrying a piece of that film with me for life. And I think there was something about Mindhorn, absurd though it was, handcuffing the wind and all the rest of it, that was so absurd, but that it chimed with something. And it was this whole sort of interplay, I think, between being, you know, what a film can do, the whole sort of Isle of Man versus Russia sort of juxtaposition, and all that stuff about going to doesn't he go for an interview with Kenneth Branagh, and he's talking about some wild night out on the Medway Downs or something, and it's sort of that bizarre mix of the parochial and the really parochial, and it really chimed with something. Yeah. And you really, in your talk, I thought that really, you really sort of encapsulated that sense of, you know, Mindhorn is us. As we wake up and look in the mirror, that's what looks back at us.
I think I might have started even by saying Mindhorn, c'est moi. I relate to that character myself, and I found out recently that Julian Barrett, who co-wrote it and played the part brilliantly, is about a month older than me. We're the same generation, as it happens. But the idea of, I talk about this in screenwriting that I also teach, desperation is often funny and a source of comedy, and Steve Coogan talks about this much better than I can, but with Mindhorn, that's what it is, where it's someone who's who feels the parade's gone by, and he's vain, and you know, a lot of actor cliches, performance cliches in the film, and so he's sending the whole thing up, but there's a pathos there, a real humanity. And yeah, I think so sometimes I show my students as part of their screenings, as a screening I show them a downbeat comedy such as the Coen brothers, Inside Llewyn Davis, and they really didn't like it because it's so bleak. It's about wanting to be an artist and getting, as it were, kicked in the head, and I'm all right with that. I think sometimes that's what it feels like, but a lot of these guys are 20 or 21 and they didn't, they're obviously looking from the other end of the telescope. But so that's not a straight comedy like Mindhorn, but it's also about desperation.
But what was interesting is watching it with different constituencies of people. Some of the screenings were with a lot of a much older demographic. At the Gulbenkian, it was a much younger one, mainly students, and they were laughing in different places. And one thing that does stand out is just in the Gulbenkian, as the credits were rolling, it said, produced by Ridley Scott, and there was a young female student in front, couldn't have been more than 20, who pointed at her friends on either side and said, look, Ridley Scott, I can't believe Ridley Scott produced this film. So again, what I got from that film was the comedy, but also the way that the comedy was apprehended very differently by the different audiences. And I just thought, it's not for me to do, but there is a thesis here somewhere.
I think so. I think it's also, it's a meditation on ageing, works on that level. Mm. It's also a genre film, so it's a kind of film about an actor, not unlike, say, Day for Night a long time ago, the Truffaut film, which is a lot greater film, by the way. But also, it's an action film, so it's got shootouts and car chases. It's spoofing Bergerac, which I'm old enough to remember from the 80s. And it's going for all of that stuff. Yeah. So I think it's a labour of love on the part of and Simon Farnaby, who co-wrote it, who's brilliant, who does lots of horrible histories stuff, has done in the past. So I think it obviously works on lots of levels.
Yeah, but going back a little bit further then, so when and where were you born? Because I'd love to know, I want to sort of see this whole route from how it all started, how you ended up doing what you're doing now. But tell me a little bit about your background.
The rich tapestry of my life. 5th of July 1968 I was born, and in Guildford. And the only good thing for me about Guildford is that it's used at the climax of The Omen, where the Antichrist triumphs over Gregory Peck in this modernist cathedral, which is Guildford Cathedral. That's the only cool thing for me. Yeah. Forget it about Guildford. I recently read that Bill Nye, the wonderful actor, went to Guildford Drama School, so that's quite good. And he used to mumble Guildford, so people would think it was Guildhall. But actually it was Guildford. So anyway, my parents moved when I was 5 because my father worked in tourism and he got a big job as managing director of a tourist attraction in the West Country. So I grew up in Somerset in the village of Wookie Hole, which is known for its caves and its paper mill and its the Witch of Wookie Hole.
Oh, I went there a few years ago.
And so we lived in the village, which is near Wells in Somerset, and it was an idyllic childhood. I loved it. I was in that village from the age of 5 till I was 13, and then we moved to a village nearby until I was around 20. So my spiritual home is Somerset, is the West Country.
Yeah, and actually, you've just reminded me that when we went down Wookie Hole, this is the thing, it was about 2011, we'd been to a family wedding the day before in Wells, and we were down in the holes and the people were dressed up as witches, and it was all sort of playing the part. And then there was this big sort of sign saying something like, Noel's house party was recorded here. And I just thought, oh dear.
Well, my father would have something to say about that. He was very worried about generating the right tone, the right image. Also, when he later on he worked at Leeds Castle here in Kent, so very much interested in sending out the right message about the kind of place you are. Noel's house party is a great example because Paul Daniels, I think, was a co-owner of Wookie Hole Caves after I was there, and. So it was a different style. It was more showbiz. I don't know if it's still owned by Jerry Cottle, who was one of the owners, and he's obviously from a circus background. And so it depends who's owning it and who's running it and what tone they want to establish. I've been back since, but when I was there in the 70s and early 80s, I remember it nostalgically as a sort of kind of prehistoric kind of place full of, you know, so caves and folklore and all of that.
And what about earliest memories? How far can you go back?
I remember someone asked me this a while back. The first thing I remember was the grass under my bare feet in our garden in Guildford, and there were daisies in the garden, and just the feel of it, that's what I feel. So I must have been 4, probably, yeah. But I don't remember much of Guildford, which is good, I think. I had to go back for many years because my grandparents lived there.
Yeah. My sister lives there, actually.
I'm just dumping all over Guildford, aren't I? It's the rump of England. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, well, I moved to Canterbury a couple of months before she moved to Guildford.
Right.
And I'm going to be very careful what I say, but I'll just say that when family members came down, that they had a different apprehension of Canterbury to that of Guildford.
Okay.
And interesting that some places, at the same time, many students are from there and very proud to be from there. But it's interesting when you're from somewhere very different, because I grew up in Cardiff and was in the University of Wales for many years, and you go to a completely different side of the country and you sometimes think, gosh, this is very expensive. This is one of the desirable places to live. Mm. And yet you sometimes think, well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's because of its proximity to London that it is so expensive, rather than perhaps in itself, because it's a place that seems to be, you know, of a particular character.
I think I talk about this now when I'm teaching, developing ideas, tribes, you know, families, or if it's Greek or Irish or whatever the particular specific tribal group is. And I found later on, going back to Guildford, you know, how tribal it is in terms of, you know, are you one of us? you know, which is memorably a phrase, the title of the biography of Margaret Thatcher by Hugo Young, one of us. So I took a stand unconsciously, in a very rather pathetic, reactionary way, and thought, I'm not one of you. No, why should I be? But I found it quite sort of powerful. Yeah. That was an aspect of Guildford conformity, I suppose.
And yeah. Was it over the disjuncture between, you know, people who were resident, who native from there, and people who'd arrive later? Was it a class thing?
Or? Well, it's interesting you ask that, because it relates to what I'm doing now, because I live in Whitstable now, and there's a real tension there. I think mainly a benevolent tension between incomers and people who are locally born and bred. And I, of course, I'm from, well, Somerset via London, and so we're a statistic, you know, we're kind of incomers in this community, and so I think I do understand that. And with Guildford, there's a lot of that's an example of a commuter town that's got lots of flux, you know, you've got people are passing through. I don't know how many people are really Guildford born and bred, but I haven't thought of that. But no, I make cheap jokes about it, and it was my mother's side of the family were what you call colonial servants, or servants of empire, and so the place to go when you'd finished doing whatever you did in what they used to call Kenya, now we call Kenya, you'd go to Surrey. Surrey was the promised land, and Guildford maybe is the jewel in Surrey's crown, right? So I think for my grandparents, you know, coming back from the colonial service, that was the place to go.
Yeah, and I remember actually it was when I had a job interview near Chatham in 2004, and I came over from Carmarthen on the train, and I knew that Kent was repeatedly the Garden of England, and I got off the train. I think I had to walk from one station to the other. I think I had to walk to Rochester Station, and I just was looking around thinking, this is very interesting, because what I was it's like Dick Whittington and the streets of London being paved with gold, and I think I was expecting to see greenery, forests, probably like Wookiee Howell, probably was what I expected Kent to look like. And of course, this is, you know, Kent is a lot bigger. We've already mentioned the Medway Downs, Medway Dip, but it's interesting, isn't it, that sometimes one's apprehension of a place, which comes from textbooks or from what you hear on the radio or the voices you hear on the radio, and it comes from just assumptions made. If you're living in a place like Carmarthen, then there's this sense that, you know, you're in one side of the country which has a particular demographic, and it's sort of a bit cut off, and it's very, you know, certainly it's a little bit far away from both Cardiff and indeed London, and so the expectation is anywhere in the southeast is going to have a very different sort of style and aesthetic. And then when you go there and you think, this is really interesting, because everything I thought about a place was completely based on assumptions that have turned out to be empirically unfounded.
I've got so many of my notions about places around the world, but certainly in the UK, from films. And, for example, Michael Powell, who was Kent born and bred, and writes about it amazingly in his memoir. And I expected... There is still that Kent that is in A Canterbury Tale, his film from 1944. But I think even now, even a few years ago when I moved here from London, I still thought, It's going to be a bit like that, and I think you have to look for it, you know. But there's so much diversity in terms of landscape and type of place in the whole of Kent. So, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. What about things you enjoyed doing as a child? You mentioned the grass under your feet, but what about particular pastimes, recreational interests, music, film?
I'm the youngest of three, and I'm the only boy. So I ended up, maybe by nature, not nurture, playing a lot on my own in a fantasy world. So a bit nerdy, I would say, very much, this is the 70s into Doctor Who and then Blake 7 and all that kind of thing. So very imaginative. But I loved Wookiee Hole and the Mendip Hills, that whole area. Is fantastic for walking, exploring, and I had friends in the village that would explore I think it was called the Woolly Rhinoceros Cave or the Hyena Den. And who knows, it's apocryphal. Supposedly, long, long ago, cavemen hunted deer. There was a place called Deer Leap, which is atop of a cliff, that the deer would be, they'd be run off the top and then harvested from where they fell by the cavemen. And all these, and I just sort of, I just absorbed all of this. So I was kind of outdoorsy, actually, not sporty, because I was so tall and gangly at a very young age, about the age of 11. So it was a balance between a lot of exploring and the landscape being so inspiring, but also lots of books and TV, all of that stuff. And my mother was a great reader, so she had so many books on the go, but read lots of crime novels, whodunits by everyone. So literally now I can recite everyone from, you know, Agatha Christie through Dorothy L. Sayers. So our TV room was lined with her crime fiction, and I was quite scared of it because I thought I would be murdered. I thought so early on. I had a fear of being murdered because if it wasn't something my mother was reading with this terrifying and tasteless cover from the 1970s, you know, Sphere or Arrow, whatever those paperbacks were, we'd be watching it on TV, yeah, or as a film, yeah, and so it was sort of there in the so I guess genre fiction, actually, so that was an aspect as well,
yeah. What about music, was that, did that play a role?
Yes, it did. I was thinking, I don't know why I thought about this, I was talking to to a colleague about the film Nowhere Boy, which is about the young John Lennon, which is a really interesting film, I think. And about the sort of the two poles of his aunt and his real mother as he's growing up in Liverpool. And I was reminded that my favourite Beatles song was Nowhere Man. Mm-hmm. And I immediately related to it. And we had there was the compilation, the Red and the Blue double albums of Beatles hits. And I remember putting the record on the turntable and watching the Apple go round and round, you know, at the centre. Yeah. And so I think I was looking for some drama in my life, which was not dramatic. I was privileged. And I thought, what if I'm a nowhere man? What if I grow up to be that? And it's a song in the film Yellow Submarine. Mm-hmm. And I love the Beatles, and that's an example of, and I think even now, thinking about John Lennon, I think a lot of, it's very male kind of hero worship, really, that needs breaking down and analysing. But I think his songwriting was childlike, often his lyrics and his imagery, and it was straight back to how you were when you were a child. So, and I responded to it when I was a child. And I listened to lots of music. I like, this is, I think they're now uncool again, having been cool briefly, and then they were uncool. ELO. I thought we're just beyond all imagining. Yeah. So I bought their albums and singles. So I loved pop music.
Because I got into them at the very tail end, literally the twilight. But that was, of course, the song that I think 1981, Hold On Tight, of course. But that was, yeah, 1981 was the year when I suddenly found the charts. And of course, ELO, yeah, had those tracks in the charts.
I'm there with you.
And yeah, this was monumental. Of course, it was only in later years that I started to find their great classics from the 70s. But there was that thing they did with Olivia Newton-John. But not too many years ago, they performed, didn't they? Radio 2, was it Live in Hyde Park?
Yeah.
And they're still, Jeff Lynne is still going,
and,
of course.
And there was because I'm the demographic, you know, white middle-aged bloke, watching BBC4 music documentaries on a weekend, I'm the perfect fodder for watching. There was a documentary about Jeff Lynne, who's, I think, now in Los Angeles, yeah, and still going strong. It was touching, actually. It was, I mean, I've got to say, there's lots of music I've listened to more now, I've discovered since then. But I think, I'm actually projecting this onto it, but I think I do like a song with a story. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Nowhere Man, sort of. But there was a single I bought called The Diary of Horace Wimp.
Mm.
And I just, I thought that was such a great story, you know, and I really related to the character. Not that, I mean, he was twice my age, and but just the story of the song, it was like a little ballad, yeah, looking back.
Yeah, and I do remember, not too many years later, the short-lived, of course, Travelling Wilburys. Okay. And that was I was 15, I was doing my GCSEs, and the Handle Me With Care, that really excited me, because you had, of course, most of them, I think all but two of them are, I think Bob Dylan and Jeff Lynne, the only ones still alive, but there was a period when this was just golden music, and it was sort of a throwback to the 60s, because you had George Harrison, Roy Orbison, and Tom Petty, who I think died quite recently, didn't he?
Great Tom Petty.
And listening to all of this and coming together, and I thought I was almost like the wrong generation for this, and it was just gold dust. And then, of course, sadly, Roy Orbison died, and the Travelling Wilburys didn't really have much longevity. But there was a period around 1988, 89 when this was just something else.
I remember exactly when it was my first or second year at university, and there was a critic at the time who'd been a musician, Andy Gill, and he gave a kind of best of year roundup in the paper. And I thought, I'm gonna buy as many of these albums as I can, and try, like, one was Womack and Womack, right? And I thought, I'm gonna, so that's great anyway. But some were more kind of, one was Was Not Was, and one was
it was Evermore the Dinosaur,
that's right, called What Up Dog. And so I bought them in a kind of spirit of experimental whatever. And we're in this house of, I think it was eight of us, in a street in sort of near the Cowley Road in Oxford, in the first or second year, I think, as a student. And they hated, my housemates hated the Travelling Wilburys album, and I was mocked. Yeah, well, one in particular just couldn't bear my choice.
But on what grounds?
Well, this particular person, who's a very good friend still, was a musician. And just it wasn't her taste, and she it was pop, you know, it was poppy, and I thought, well, that's fine, isn't it? And the thing is, it's very well crafted. The music, the songs are beautifully crafted, and So, but I remember very clearly getting those. But there's a I'm just thinking about Jeff Lynne in the documentary. He talks about his love of Roy Orbison, and. And you can hear it in how early ELO songs are, but then also how he produced people later, like Roy Orbison, but then also Tom Petty. There's a through line to the whole thing. But yeah, so I don't know. I bought all kinds of. Some of it was terrible. Some was just terrible. The albums I bought, and some of my gambles paid off.
What was one of the worst ones? What was one of the gambles that either did or didn't pay off, but which was perhaps not quite what you were expecting it to be?
That's a good one. I give just about everything a try. I remember going through a phase of liking kind of San Francisco acid rock. This is true, and thinking I ought to like all this stuff like Jefferson Airplane and 13th Floor Elevators and all of that, and. I bought one album by one of those bands, Quicksilver Messenger Service, Happy Trails, and I just thought, I think I was trying to be cool or in some, and I just didn't like it, you know. Maybe I just yearned for ELO, the real me. Yeah. I was putting on a persona. It was not for me. So it's documented better elsewhere. But a lot of that music is you know. Repetitious, you know, and you've got to be in the mood.
Jefferson Starship, Jefferson Airplane, did they become Starship?
They did. They were Jefferson Starship, and then they were just Starship. Nothing's going to stop us now. With the voice of Grace Slick that can kind of blast through several layers of steel. So it was really important to me, the music, and I went to boarding school when I was 13. And that was another tribal identifier there, what music you liked. So it might be the Rolling Stones, it might be The Cure, this being the 80s, it was often The Cure, or Echo and the Bunnymen. And so that was another thing. I remember liking a more new wave type stuff like The Teardrop Explodes, and going home and playing these two records to death, and my sister just... couldn't stand it. You know, I just, but it's treason and reward and those things. I play them.
Bless my cotton socks. Yeah. I'm in the nude.
Yeah. And there's one of the songs starts with "I've been living through changes," and I thought that's so deep. And I was 14 or 15. Yeah. That's really cosmic. Yeah. And she just couldn't stand it. You know. So I loved. So I basically I tried just about everything Catholic tastes, and I still do a little bit. I still kind of do that, and I tease my wife that she liked kind of middle of the road stuff like Phil Collins and Deacon Blue. I'm sorry that I realise they're very very successful, talented performers, but at the time they were not for me. You know, and that I would try more, you know. Edgy stuff like Teardrop Explodes. This is nonsense, isn't it? But anyway,
but you're right, there was something very tribal about music in the I was only 7 or 8 in 1981, but I was very aware of that. You had everything from Bad Manners,
yep,
to Teardrop Explodes to the Swords of a Thousand Men, Temple Tudor, but you also had Shakin' Stevens and Bucks Fizz. It was such a peculiar juxtaposition.
I think. I recently read the most fantastic memoir and by Brett Anderson, who is the same age as me, actually. He used to be lead, well, he is still lead singer of Suede, but also a singer-songwriter. And it was about growing up in suburbia and before they made it. And I just found it captured so well, without sounding pompous, my generation, which is similar to yours, you know, very close in age. Mm. And that mixture of tacky pop and some very interesting. So I remember around the same time that the Stranglers' Golden Brown was number 2. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of unspeakable stuff next to it in the charts. And that was the whole point of Top of the Pops.
Now this is you're up. Is the Stranglers' Golden Brown is one of those sort of greatest songs.
Yeah.
Never Ultravox Vienna being the obvious one, and Fairy Tale of New York. But was it the Goombay Dance Band that was number one?
Please, Chris. I've got a bit like films. I've got a kind of list of the worst records of all time, but also the worst number ones. And Seven Tears by the Goombay Dance Band is top three. It's just appalling because it doesn't even have. I don't think it's even got a kind of camp excuse, like songs like I've Never Been to Me by Charlene. Mm-hmm. They've got... the reason I could talk about this, and I do, ad nauseam, is I used to write the top 10 down every week. So I think it's more of a boy than a girl thing. When you're a certain age, you get into it. It might be dinosaurs or model making or aeroplanes, whatever. And mine was pop trivia. Yeah. And I'm not proud. And I had the Guinness books of British hit singles, all that stuff.
You'll find one on the shelf behind you.
And I loved all of that. And so from 1980 until probably when I lost my virginity, I would write, and then I got interested in other things. I wrote down the top 10 every week. And listened on a Tuesday lunchtime or whenever it was. And I think it was just a sort of, I've been told by friends off and on that, you know, apart from being quite sad, it's a sort of male need to collect, to order stuff. And that's what I did.
Yeah. No, I did that for years, exactly the same as you. Tuesday lunchtimes, it was DLT in those days, wasn't it, with the charts, 12:45, school playground, and you'd count down the top five, and we were all very excited around our transistor radios and waited to see what was number one.
Yeah.
One that does come to mind particularly, it would have been 1985, and it was that Dead or Alive, You Spin Me Around Like a Record. Yeah. That was a very audacious song with Pete Burns.
It still sounds good, and the thing is, it's great to badmouth now. Stock Aitken and Waterman.
Yeah, that was one of their very early hits, wasn't it?
And actually, you know, lots of their singles sound really fresh now. I'm not supposed to say this. There's no cachet in saying how, but some of those singles, obviously, they sold a load. That's a great example. So certainly, all the way through school. I mean, I remember very clearly different terms, even down to the month. Like for example, when Dr. Hook. When You're in Love with a Beautiful Woman was number one. It's that they're, you know, markers all the way through. all the way through, and then kind of probably tailing off from the late 80s onwards. But
I caught the tail end of that again, and it's interesting how with Donna Summer particularly, they her career was, for a generation like me who were a bit too young to remember I Feel Love, but very much knew who she was. Yeah. Suddenly, with This Time I Know It's For Real, and even now, when that comes on my music tapes, because I used to record all the stuff in those days and digitised it some years ago, I have to confess that, that goes up a little bit. It's the sort of thing, is it cool to like it? I don't know, but Donna Summer was the epitome of cool. But then she worked with Stock Aitken and Waterman. So that was a strange one, because there were all those manufactured artists who, and what was that? I'd Rather Jack Than Fleetwood Mac. Is that, I mean, that was like, that as juxtapositions go, that was one of the more curious ones. But then the Reynolds Girls, wasn't it? But then with Donna Summer, it was like, well, actually, she's a serious artist. And I was fascinated that there were obviously some people, they knew that it was a guaranteed hit, and Cliff Richard was expecting something like his 100th single. It didn't quite make it to number one, but he knew that if he worked with Stock Aitken and Waterman, there was more of a guarantee of a hit.
You know more than me here. You know more than me in this area. So it was really happy, that whole involvement with and I used to even know what was number one when someone was born. Someone used to say my birthday was whatever it is, let's say, August 1974, and I would know.
Terry Jacks? No.
I think it might be.
Well, what was number
Seasons
one?
Seasons in the Sun.
Yeah. What was number one when you were born?
No, well, that's easy. No, it's Baby Come Back by the Equals.
Oh, fantastic. Eddie Grant,
But my good friend Adam, who now lives in New York, he was born 2 or 3 weeks before me, and Jumping Jack Flash was number one. Mm. So I'm jealous, really, because that would be great to have. This is so, I realise how ridiculous it is, but I still, sometimes, you get the, whatever it is, the 60s show, or what's it called?
Pick of the Pops, Sounds of the 60s.
And I will know what the top five are, or certainly number one, and it's really, it's my lonely destiny.
Well, not so lonely. Well, no doubt, when we finish recording, we will continue this conversation. This is one of my, and to this day, the whole sense of identity formation around the charts. And so for me, Pick of the Pops is a ritual to this day. And it's interesting, the song that was number one when I was born was Wizard and See My Baby Jive. Yes. Have to say, not one of my favourite songs, but there's actually Charlene and
Angel
to me.
Fingers, which was the other number one.
That's the number one that nobody knows was number one. That's right.
You were lucky. It was See My Baby Jive. Could have been much worse. It could have been three friends of mine at some stage. I've slightly lost touch with them. I worked out, this is quite niche. Each of them, their birthdays were when the Brotherhood of Man were each number one. So Angelo. One was born with Angelo, one was Figaro, and one was Save Your Kisses for Me. All around, kind of between 76 and 77. It's like, and I thought, what are the chances of that happening?
Yeah. Well, what about your, I can't really say decision to enter academia, because there's obviously a lot for you to unpack first, because we've covered the film making angle, but how did you end up at the University of Kent?
So I am a late developer, I think. I was 42 when I became a father for the first time. So, around 40 when I was first teaching screenwriting. So before that, I was working in development, mainly in radio and TV and film. So I loved teaching screenwriting, and fortunately, it went very well. It was reciprocated. I got strong feedback, so they asked me back, and then that all kind of snowballed. And I think, I'm biased, obviously, but the School of Arts has got this very interesting identity as a place for filmmaking and film studies. So it's been a very kind of soft landing for me. I'm not talking about possible other universities I might have ended up at, but I'm delighted it's here. I think almost all of my skills so far I've translated into my teaching. So some practical experience from the industry, but also I suppose talking about music, not censoring people's ideas, not saying it's embarrassing, whatever it might be, and people apologise for themselves. And I've done all that. I mean, I've actually done that in the last half hour, haven't I? And so it's that outlook that I use here that I hope comes in handy. But so do you want more specifics about how exactly I started?
Well, not necessarily, but what I'm interested in is that I'm assuming that you initially studied film.
Right. So I studied modern languages at Oxford University, and I went to St. Hugh's College, and I spent a year abroad in Germany. So I studied French and German. And but even then, I was a kind of film buff / bore. So I used to show films at university, and that was my main passion. And I used to act, so I was not a good student actor, and it's no loss to acting. But it has come in handy, I believe, because I love acting and actors. Right? I'm very interested in that world, and I always was. So after 2 years in London, after graduating, I went to film school in my mid-20s at Bournemouth Film School, and which then, if not now, was kind of the poor relation to the National Film School and the Royal College of Art, which are the big stellar film schools at the time. But Bournemouth produced some amazing filmmakers, such as Simon Beaufoy, so among many others. So,
Phil Monty. He wrote
Monty, and he wrote *Slumdog Millionaire*. Very interesting writer. So, and others, not just Simon. So, but I spent 2 years at film school there, and then I worked in the film industry for 3 years on other people's films, crewing on a couple of feature films and other projects, Channel 4 films. And then I got a break to work at the BBC Northern Ireland, but it was the London wing. So I would fly back and forth to Belfast or Derry, and then later I'd go to Dublin and Galway. And so that part of my life in my 30s was closely connected with Ireland, and it was a really happy time. And I produced a lot of radio dramas, directed some short films, and worked in the industry, really, and tried to get my own film off the ground or develop other people's, really being a freelancer and not making a good living as a writer-director in London, just hanging on. But some of it was amazing.
Yeah. And when you were at university, or indeed subsequently, what about some of those wider interests? Film was obviously a big thing for you, but what would you say really stands out from your time at university?
I did try just about everything. Sport, because by then I was coordinated. Around the age of 16, suddenly, who knew I was coordinated? But also a lot of acting. So, and I did all the cliched student productions, such as, in the same term, I was in a production of The Duchess of Malfi and Dr. Faustus. So very, very predictable fare. So that, and I went to the Edinburgh Festival in the August of my first year, representing, the whole university, so students from all kinds of different colleges, and with five plays, with each of us performing in at least two. So that was really important to me, and meeting people from all the different colleges, quite a wide pool of backgrounds. I think I'm just trying to think. The year I spent in Germany was a watershed, so that's my third year. The equivalent of, I guess, what students, whether it's SECL or elsewhere here, they go to Italy or they year abroad. And it was the year of the fall of communism. It was 1989 to 1990. So I went to Berlin three times that year, and each time there was less and less wall until the final visit in June 1990, it had gone. So I sat on the wall in November 89, and it was so exciting because every month another former communist country, there'd been a dramatic change. So it was Hungary, what was Czechoslovakia, Romania.
That was the big Christmas Day story in 1989, right, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's
the execution of
the 22nd. That's right, 22nd of December. I remember it, and it was so grim, but also sort of tectonic plate shifting. So that was a big experience. Was that year of travel, really? And I went to Russia. I went to St. Petersburg and or Leningrad, as it was then, and Moscow. So real variety, traveling around Germany and Switzerland, France, you know, a lot of the experiences. So I suppose I got a taste for travel.
Yeah.
That became a big thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And what about other things? I mean, politics, religion. I mean, what was the sort of cauldron? I mean, this would have been Thatcher's Britain.
Yes. So my background is utterly sort of right of centre. Church of England, rump of England, as I said earlier. And so both sides of my family, you know, my parents are Tories. And as I got older, I realised that that was not my ideology. And maybe, again, you could say it's a knee-jerk reaction. It's a middle-class rebellion, whatever it is. But once I realised that, having gone to boarding school, which is part of that mindset, I understood sort of my position, really. It took until I was 18 or 19 or 20, but until then I kind of thought, this is quite strange and quite repressive. And I remember there was a conservative Skittles evening in a village in Somerset, and I went there, and my mum and dad went to sort of support the local MP who'd been a war hero, and Tory MP, and my job was to pick up the Skittles after they'd been knocked over in this Skittle alley at the back of this smelly boozer somewhere in Somerset. And just, again, it was tribal, and I thought, I don't know, it was my mum and dad's social group. And and then moving forward, so Thatcher's Britain, and everyone, sort of parents of my friends at boarding school, but also the builders fixing stuff, were pro-Thatcher. Everyone was, so it's easy to forget, you know, obviously there was a landslide and there was a lot of support for her, and I remember finding that strange. But as far as religion goes, I went to church sometimes every Sunday, and I just didn't, I mean, I'm interested now in, I talk about religion in my teaching with a small r, and we overlap there because, you know, you teach film and religion, and it's essential, you know, an understanding of many, many filmmakers, not least Scorsese, but others. I just, you know, grew out of it, and that wasn't, I think my father still occasionally goes to church. My mother was really not a religious person. She was, I think, an atheist is a polite way of putting it. She did not like to go to church. But because we were growing up in a village, part of the community is you would see people at church. It was part of the community's life, you know, and like the, you know, Reverend Davis, you know, the vicar, and, you know, who you'd see in Mrs. Ferguson playing the organ, right? And you know, it was part of being the community.
Yeah, and certainly when I went to university, because that was kind of my background as well. I used to go to my local and serve at my local Anglican church, went to university and then started studying theology, and then something very different happened, because suddenly it was a case of, rather than follow a particular path or a particular orthodox line, or because there's something very conformist about Anglicanism. And I found then that I was able to ask all these penetrating questions without somebody saying, oh, you're not allowed to do that. And I was suddenly thrust into a whole world of life after death and questions around secularisation in the Victorian era and various schisms in the early church. And I thought, this really is for me, because it was a case of being able to have an inquisitive mind. Yeah. And I moved away from my church background.
Right. How interesting. So yes, I think I got quite politicised as I moved away from my background. And also, I think just after I graduated in 92, that was John Major was Prime Minister, and that, people may forget, that was so contentious. There was a sense that, you know, it was, we were in the doldrums, but on balance, the vote was to stay with that government. And that was, I was a member of the Labour Party, and around the age of 24, I can't remember, and such a sense of defeat and disappointment.
I was convinced it was going to go. It was the first election which I voted. Yeah,
his famous trip.
Sheffield.
Well, Sheffield was, that's it. It wasn't because he tripped on the beach and fell over, but it was, it was Sheffield. It was the rally. It was the triumphalist. And so I remember all of that. I mean, now I'm with someone who's, my wife is from Yorkshire. She's from the north. She's from a working class Northern Catholic background. You know, and it's so, so different. We're from really different tribes. Mm. But politically, ideologically, we're in alignment. Yeah. But I find, I think that sort of differentness I love. You know, I find it stimulating. Yeah. And I think even, I hope we all do, but I even as a student, I did. That sort of, like, trying to find someone who wasn't, you know, wasn't like me, whether I was pretending not to be from my background or not, but just,
A few more philosophically based questions before we wrap up. Would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones over your whole life?
Yes, I would. I make tasteless, facetious jokes about just about anything. Have a very dark sense of humour, but actually, I had a very happy childhood, and I don't have a sense of guilt about it. I have done sometimes because, relatively, I'm so privileged, so sort of middle class, sailing through. It didn't feel like it at the time, but now I know, you know, how unequal things can be for many people. So, but yes, I'm pretty happy. And then when I do lose my temper with my two small children, you know, it's like, it's usually an anomaly. So I'm fairly, and I think it was developed when I worked with actors as a director, where you have to supply the energy. Sometimes someone's got to do it. And in a way, I'm doing that now in my seminars. And often that comes from, you've got to find a way of being happy.
Sometimes we're faking it.
Yeah, because there is that related question, isn't there, as to whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences?
That's really interesting. I mean, I've talked to both my sisters about childhood events now, you know, recollected, and what was that really, what was going on? I think, for example, we used to go on the most brutal holidays in Wales. Right? And it was sort of like a parody of kind of ascetic hair shirt. We're going to swim in the mountain pool, and there was no hot water, no electricity in this, what was a shepherd's cottage. I have happy memories of it. But actually, I think they were quite strange. We were a different family, and I don't think they were that happy holidays. But I'm not nostalgic for it, but does that sort of answer your question?
No, it does, because sometimes it's that sense of looking back from the vantage point of being in your 40s over something which might have been very pedestrian, very humdrum, or maybe in some cases not all that pleasant, but something happened, it was a rite of passage, a bit like all those sort of Stand By Me, you know, adaptations from Stephen King short stories, where there's something that, there's a challenge, and there's something that you learn from, and then that becomes something really special, that if it hadn't happened, then you would in some way be still a child, should we say. There's sort of that sense of growing up, maybe before you are quite at adolescence, but there is something that happens that changes your life from then on?
The big thing was for me was going to boarding school when I was 13, and ironically, the song that was number one was "Don't You Want Me" by the Human League, and of course, that is how you feel. I mean, I'm vehemently opposed to the idea of boarding schools. I know they have changed since the 80s, so it's not like Tom Brown's school days, and in terms of, but just you feel, if not unwanted, you don't want to leave home. Yeah. And for me, it's unthinkable with my children, the idea that, okay, well, whether it was at the age of 8 in the past with prep schools, or in the time of empire, or age 13, which is the case for me. So I think it hugely affected my relationship with my older sisters, because I left home, and also with my parents. And so I think there was a disconnect from then on. So that was, I think, you know, it really, my wife will back me up on this. It definitely, definitely had an impact. Yeah.
And have you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young?
Well, the kind of big one, at some age, I thought I would be David Lean, the great film director. No, but in every other way, I think I have. I've not in a stroppy sort of, I don't think in that driven a way have I pursued my dreams, but I've done mostly what I wanted to. So, you know, going to film school, working around film, working around actors. I think it now looks like I made it up as I went along, but maybe I did. But yeah, I think I'm trying to think what my dreams were. It was usually to do with either acting or possibly writing as well, which is something I also started. I've not answered the question. I don't know.
I think you have is the answer, because you, what you're doing now is the chance to do both of those. You get to write.
Yeah.
You certainly get to read students' written work, and also, of course, you get to do film-based practical work as well.
I mean, the huge thing for me is, which you must relate to, is having children. So, and that was why the Brett Anderson book was so touching, because he talks about, now he's a father and relating it to, he talks about his parents. But so with my son and my daughter, you get a direct line to who you were when you were 8. You know, if I'm talking to my 8-year-old son, and there's moments that it's just, it just sort of opens up like the Red Sea. And there it is, and you're there, you can return there. So so actually we go on holiday some summers to the place that we used to go as children. And I think that doesn't even bear analysis. That's so obvious. But we go back to this village in Scotland where I used to go when I was 8 or 9. And, you know, it's an old-fashioned bucket and spade. You know, we must be the only people who... We go north in the summer instead of south to the Mediterranean. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like there's a novel in there.
Yeah, maybe, yes. Don't get me started.
Or an autobiography.
Don't tempt me, Chris. Yeah.
But my very last question then, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'm looking forward, I think. I think because I love stories, and I am constantly aware of influences from my past, whether it's Teardrop Explodes or... Doctor Who, whatever it might be. So no, I love creativity, and I just think it can always be put into something moving forwards, I think. But reflection, you know, is so vital, and reflection suggests looking back, but I think it's also looking forward. I think it's just finding equilibrium, isn't it? And that's a challenge.
Lawrence, it has been amazing to catch up today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris.